Let's turn to 2 Kings chapter 8 this evening, and let's continue our journey through the book. 2 Kings chapter 8. When Elisha first began his ministry, there was a woman who recognized that he was a man of God. And so she provided hospitality. In fact, even had her husband build him a little room so that whenever he passed by that way, he could stop and refresh himself and could sleep there. And she just provided for him. In time, he wanted to return the favor to her, and he asked what he could do for her, and he said, "Shall I talk to the king?" She says, "No, I'm, you know, satisfied. I dwell peaceably." And his servant, Gehazi, said, "She doesn't have any child." And so he called her in, and he said, "Next year, about this time, you'll be nursing a baby." And she said, "Oh, don't put me on." And he said, "No, you know, you'll have a child." So she did have a son. Her husband was an older man. They had not been able to have children. But God gave to her a son. One day, the little boy was out in the field with his father, and he evidently had a heat stroke. He said, "My head, my head." And so the father had the servants rush him back to his mother, where he laid on her lap and died. And so she laid him in the prophet's chamber, and she ordered the servant to saddle the donkey, and she said, "Don't slow down unless I tell you." And so she came riding furiously to Mount Carmel, where the prophet Elisha was staying at that time. And when he saw her coming, he realized the haste and all by which she was coming. Something was evidently wrong. He sent Gehazi, his servant, out to ask her if everything is okay. And she said, "Everything is okay." But she continued driving on. And as she came to Elisha, she grabbed hold of his feet. And Gehazi said, "Shall I cast her away?" And he said, "No, there's something troubling her, and the Lord hasn't shown me." So she said, "Why didn't I tell you, don't deceive me, when you said that I was going to have a child?" And Elisha said to Gehazi, "Take my staff and put it upon the child. Hurry." And she said, "You're going with me." So she took Elisha back, and he laid down upon the child. And God restored her son to life, an outstanding miracle. But this relationship had developed between Elisha and the family of this Shunammite woman. So that when the Lord showed Elisha that the land was going to experience 7 years of drought, he came to this woman, chapter 8, whose son he had restored to life, and he said, "Arise, and with your household, go and sojourn wherever you can. For the Lord hath called for a famine, and it's going to be on the land for 7 years. So don't stay in the land of Israel. God is going to bring judgment by reason or by way of a famine. It's going to last for 7 years. And so it came to pass at the end of the 7 years that the woman came back from the land of the Philistines, where she had gone to dwell during the time of the famine. And someone had taken over her house and her property. And so she came to the king for the restoration of her house and of her land. Now, Gehazi, who was the servant of Elisha, was talking with the king. For the king had asked him to tell me about this man of God. Gehazi had, of course you remember, gotten in trouble when Naaman, the Syrian captain, had come to Elisha to be healed of his leprosy. And Elisha sent Gehazi out to him with a message, go down to the Jordan River, dip yourself in the water 7 times, and you'll be recovered from your leprosy. And he headed back to Syria, angry as could be, angry at the prophet of God for not even having the courtesy to come out and tell him himself, sent the servant out. We've got better rivers in Damascus, you know, and he was determined that he wasn't going to follow the advice of the prophet. But his servant said to him, look, if he had asked you to do some terribly difficult thing, you would have been glad to do it. How much more than that? He just says a simple thing, dip yourself, why don't you, and see what would happen. And so he dipped himself in the Jordan River 7 times, and he came up, his flesh was like that of a little child. He was cured completely of the leprosy. Well, he came back to Elisha and wanted to reward him, wanted to lay a lot of loot on him, actually, gold and silver and changes of apparel. And Elisha, unlike the modern evangelist today, said, no, you keep it. I don't need anything from your hand, you know, you keep it, I don't want it. And so the servant Gehazi, this servant Gehazi, as Naaman went away, he thought, man, if I just had a part of that loot, I could buy vineyards, I could buy olive orchards, I could hire servants. Man, I could be set up. And so he slipped away, and he went chasing down the road after Naaman. And so they saw him coming, and they stopped, and they said, is everything okay? He said, oh, yes, everything is okay, except that just after you left, my master had a couple of young prophets come in who needed help. And so if you could just give a couple of the bars of gold and a couple of changes of raiment, you know, it would help them out, and my master would appreciate it. And the fellow says, oh, here, take 4, you know. And he loaded the gifts on Gehazi, who came back and hid them and came in to Elisha. And Elisha said, where have you been? I've been anywhere. He said, oh, as you went, did not my spirit go with you? Is this a time to receive rewards? Is this a time to buy vineyards and orchards and to hire servants? And he began to read the intentions of Gehazi, what he intended to do with this money. He said, the leprosy that was upon Naaman will cling to you. And he turned a leper, went out from the presence of Elisha. No longer a servant of Elisha, he now is talking with the king. He's become sort of an entertainer for the king of sorts. No longer is he able to actually participate in the work of God, but now he is rehearsing what God did. It's always a sign of a sad state of spiritual affairs when you have to talk about the work of God in the past tense. When there isn't that present work of God within your life that you're excited about, things that God is doing this day or this past week, the Lord has been so good. But when you have to say, well, I can remember, you know, back in the days of the tent. Oh, those were exciting days, you know. When you have to go back to find excitement in the work of the Lord, it should be something that is fresh day by day, the discovery of God's grace unto us. And so Gehazi is now entertaining the king with the stories. Tell me what this guy Elisha did. Tell me some of the stories. And so he's become an entertainer as he relates to the king the stories of the past. Well, it just so happened in one of those coincidental things, if you believe in coincidences, that as he was telling the king how Elisha had raised this boy and brought the dead body back to life, that just as he was telling this story, here came in the woman with her son, because she is wanting to get a judgment from the king that will cause the people who appropriated her property to give it back. So she came in at that very time he's telling the story, this marvelous story of the raising of the son. She comes in, and Gehazi says, "Hey, there's the woman right there, and that's her boy. That's the one I'm telling you about." And so the king asked her concerning the story. And so she related to him the same story of how God had brought her son back to life. So the king appointed an officer to see that she got back all of her property and all of the fruit of the property during the 7 years that she was gone. Now, in a typology, for those that are interested in typology, and it is an interesting subject, this woman becomes the type of the nation of Israel that will be restored by God. And when restored by God, will receive all of the fruit that it was deprived of during the years that others had appropriated her property. But Israel, even as the woman, will receive this grace and benefit because of the resurrection of the dead son. So the son, of course, being raised from the dead, becomes a type of Jesus Christ, and Israel's blessings that will come to her as the result of the resurrection of the dead son. And so you have an interesting type from the Old Testament. Now, Elisha, meanwhile, we come back to Elisha now, has gone up to the capital of Syria, Damascus. And Ben-Hadad, who was the king of Syria, was told, he was sick, and he was told that the man of God, that is Elisha, has come here. He was very familiar with Elisha. He was the one who sent his captain Naaman down for the curing of his leprosy. Elisha had been revealing all of his plans of attacks against Samaria to the king of Samaria. And he thought that one of his generals was a spy, and he found out that there was a man of God in Israel who knew everything he said. And so he sent his army to capture Elisha. But instead, Elisha captured his army and delivered his army to the king of Samaria. And so he was familiar with Elisha, and they said, "Hey, that man of God is here." And so he sent Hazael to take a present in his hand and to go and to meet the man of God and inquire of Jehovah by him, saying, "Shall I recover of this disease? Is this fatal? You know, it's an interesting thing. Whenever we've been sick for a while, we somehow think, you know, that it's this is it. You know, this is the rest of my life. I'm going to bear this infirmity. I'm going to have this particular pain or something, you know, from now on. And It's crazy the way our minds work. A week of sickness and we think we're dead, you know. And so he was wondering, you know, am I going to recover from this disease? So Hazael went to meet him, and he took the present with him of all of the good things of Damascus. Actually, 40 camels were loaded down with presents for the prophet. And he said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, has sent me to thee, saying, 'Shall I recover of this disease?' And Elisha said unto him, 'Go and say to him, you may certainly recover. Howbeit, the Lord has shown me that he shall surely die.'" Interesting answer. It leaves a little confusion until you read the rest of the story. And so Elisha settled his countenance steadfastly. That is, he began to stare intently at Hazael. And as he began to stare intently at him, until actually it was sort of embarrassing, he then began to weep. And Hazael said, "Why are you weeping?" And Elisha said, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you're going to set on fire. Their young men you will slay with a sword. Their children you will dash in the streets, and you will rip up the pregnant girls." And Hazael said, "But what is thy servant, a dog, that he should do these horrible things?" And Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you shall be the king over Syria." Now, if you remember back a few chapters, actually back in 1 Kings, one of the duties that God appointed Elijah, remember when Elijah had fled to Mount Horeb from the wrath of Jezebel? And while he was there in Mount Horeb, the Lord came to him as he was standing in the cave, at the mouth of the cave, and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "Oh, I've been jealous for God, you know, and they've slain all your prophets. I'm the only one left, you know, and they're trying to kill me." And so the Lord finally said, "Look, go on up to Syria and anoint Hazael to be the king over Syria." And God commissioned him on two or three little tasks that he was to perform. We don't know, the scripture doesn't say that he ever got to Syria to anoint Hazael, but this is the same Hazael. Now Elisha is saying to him, "The Lord has shown me that you are going to be the king over Syria." But the interesting part of this story is that he did not know the evil that was in his own heart. And it is difficult for us to know the evil that is in our own hearts. Given the right circumstances, given the right situation, the evil things that we are capable of doing. Though we might swear, "I would never do that." And if someone would tell us the things that we are capable of doing, we would be insulted. We would be as Hazael, who said, "Am I a dog that I would do such things? Are you, you know, what do you think I am, man?" He did not know the potential for evil that was in his own heart. And we do not realize the potential for evil that is in the unregenerate heart of man. Jesus said that out of the heart proceeds the murders, the adulteries, the fornications, the thefts, and all of these things. And it is possible for a person to find himself involved in situations that he would at one time in his life considered abhorrent. Things that you've condemned others for doing. And yet you find yourself guilty of doing those very same things. It was in your heart also. So much of what is done for the impression of others. Because we do want people to think well of us. We want people to like us. We want people to respect and admire us. And so much of what we do is done just for the sake of impressing others. But the sad thing about that is that we impress ourselves. And we begin to think more highly of ourselves than we ought, though the Scripture warns us not to. Therefore, let no man think more highly of himself than he ought, but rather think soberly and diligently, realizing that whatever you have that's of good or worth has been given to you. If it was given to you, then why should you boast as though it wasn't given to you? If you have any talent, capacity, or ability, it's because God has given it to you. Any goodness that is there, it's come to you as a gift of God. Then if it is a gift of God, why should you boast about what you've done if it was something that God has done? So, in deceiving others, we deceive ourselves and we develop this self-image of the wonderful me. The sweet and the kind and the generous me. I'm really sort of the perfect man. And whenever I do anything that is contrary to that image of myself, then I have a good reason for having done it. And I begin to excuse my bad temper, my bad actions. I really didn't mean to do that. That just slipped, you know, and it was this horrible pressure. I just wasn't myself, you know. I plead insanity, temporary insanity. It works in the court, so you. But that isn't the real me. That was some ugly. And it's interesting with our little granddaughter, who is the sweetest, most perfect little girl in the world. But every once in a while, she doesn't come to visit us, but Prunella comes to visit us. And Prunella is a mean little girl. And she does nasty things. She sticks out her tongue and she sasses and all of this kind of stuff. Our perfect little granddaughter wouldn't do that kind of thing. And thus it's Prunella who has disguised herself as our granddaughter who does those things. There's two of all of us, isn't there? We've all got the Prunella side. We don't like it. We don't want to recognize it. We don't want to admit to it. But the Scripture is true, and the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. And the only hope I have is the surrendering of my heart and life to be controlled by the Spirit. And if a person, a prophet of God, could stare in our eyes and tell us the things that we are capable of doing in the flesh, We would respond to them, "Am I a dog that I would do such things?" We would be shocked, we would be abhorred and insulted, we would be repulsed, as was Haziel. He was repulsed by these suggestions. "I would dash a baby in the street, I would rip up a pregnant woman. Am I a dog? Who do you think I am, man?" And yet these very things Haziel was guilty of. It was there. And the prophet could see it. And he here becomes a type of Jesus who weeps over Jerusalem because he can see the devastation that is going to come. He saw the children being dashed in the streets. He saw the temple on fire. He could hear the screams of the people being cremated within it. And as he looked at Jerusalem, he wept because he could see. He said, "If you only knew the things that belong to thy peace, but they are hid from your eyes, and now your children are going to be dashed in your streets." And he went on to tell of the horrible carnage that would take place. And so Elisha, the prophet, being able to see what was going to happen to the people of God through this man, through this instrument, through Haziel, seeing what he was going to do, he wept over the fate of Israel in the hands of Haziel. So he departed from Elisha, and he came to his master Ben-Hadad the king, who said to him, "What did Elisha say?" And he answered, "He told me that you would surely recover." But it came to pass on the next day that he took a thick cloth and dipped it in water and spread it on his face so that he died. He suffocated him. And Haziel reigned in his stead. So already the man who was shocked the day before when the prophet suggested that he was capable of doing evil things, and "Am I a dog? I would do these things." In the very next day, he is guilty of murder. Murders the king. Now we turn from there to the genealogies of the kings again. And here it becomes a little sticky. So I'll do my best to explain it, and you do your best to follow. We are dealing with the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. The sticky part comes as that for a time here, both of them are going to be ruled over kings by the same name, Joram or Jehoram. The names are the same, but they are both called Jehoram and they are both called Joram. And the interesting thing is that there is a relationship between Joram and Jehoram in that they are brothers-in-law. The sister of Joram, who was the king of Israel, his sister was married to Joram, who became the king of Judah. She was one wicked gal, and we'll be looking at her in the next few chapters. In the next 2 weeks or so, we'll be looking at this woman, Athaliah, who was the daughter of Jezebel and King Ahab, and thus the sister of Joram, who was the king of Israel. So, in the fifth year of Joram, who was reigning in Israel, Jehoshaphat, being the king over Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, began to reign in Judah. So his stepbrother had been reigning for 5 years in the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, Jehoshaphat, who was the king of Judah, was a fairly good king. However, he seemed to somehow be attracted to Ahab, who was an extremely wicked king. There should have really been no place of fellowship for these two guys. What fellowship hath light with darkness? What concourse hath Christ with Belial? But Jehoshaphat seemed to have some strange fascination for this horribly wicked King Ahab. And he had come up to visit Ahab. And in fact, you remember it was last week or so that Ahab said, "How would you like to go to battle with me? You know, we're going to go over and try and take Ramoth Gilead back from the Syrians." And he said, "You know, I am as you and my men like your men, and, you know, let's go for it." And so Jehoshaphat went to battle, and that was the battle in which Ahab was killed. And Jehoshaphat fled for his life. Well, now, in this getting involved with this wicked king, they no doubt, in the friendship that had developed between them, made this marriage arrangement, for marriage was by arrangement in those days, that, hey, look, I have a fine young son, you have a pretty young daughter, why don't we, marry the two, and then we'll be related. So there came this relationship of the kingdoms during this period of history. When Jehoshaphat, the king of Israel, married off his son Jehoram unto Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And so it was an ungodly alliance that brought havoc on both kingdoms. The northern kingdom was already in a mess, but now it introduces this same kind of corruption into the southern kingdom through Athaliah. And so it's a very sad thing that many times, though a parent may be able to escape from getting into total corruption by his acquaintances, the kids are the ones that get hurt. And so, though Jehoshaphat was able to keep himself sort of clear from that stuff, his son Jehoram was a mess and went right into the evil practices, no doubt through the influence of his wife Athaliah. And her influence, unfortunately, went on for a while and affected her son, who began to reign, and it went on a while. And we'll, as I say, we'll be following her, coming back to her from time to time. So, we read that Jehoram, the king of Judah, was 32 years old when he began to reign, but he only reigned for 8 years. That means that he died when he was 40 years old. But, and here's the sad commentary, verse 18, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel who were corrupt, as did the house of Ahab, which was the most corrupt of all the kings of Israel. For the daughter of Ahab, that is Athaliah, was his wife, and he did evil in the sight of Jehovah. And yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for David, his servant's sake, as he promised, to give him always a light and to his children. So God was merciful for David's sake and did not destroy the family of Jehoram completely. There was a wipeout, and we'll get that. Now, in the days that Jehoram was the king over Judah, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah, and they made their own king. So Joram, who is also Jehoram, and this is the contraction of his name, went over unto Zair with all of the chariots with him, and he rose by night and smote the Edomites, which had encircled him, And the captains of the chariots and the people, the Edomites, fled into their tents. And yet Edom continued rebelling from under the hand of Judah unto the present day, that is, unto the time that this was written. And then Libna revolted at the same time. And the rest of the acts of Joram and all that he did, are they not written in the chronicles of the kings of Judah? So when we're through with 2 Kings, we get to 1 and 2 Chronicles. So we haven't left this guy completely yet. For when we get to the Chronicles, we will come across Jehoram once again. And Joram slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. And Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, he only reigned for 8 years. He was 40 years old when he died. And thus his son was pretty young when he began to reign. So in the 12th year, his brother-in-law is still reigning up in Israel. In the 12th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, did Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, the king of Judah, begin to reign. He was 22 years old. That means he was 18 years old, or his father was 18 years old when he was born. And he was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned only for 1 year. Wicked kid. And God wasn't going to allow him to continue long in his wickedness. His mother's name was Athaliah, who was the granddaughter of Omri, the king of Israel. She was the daughter of Ahab. And he walked in the way of the house of Ahab. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, as did the house of Ahab, for he was the son-in-law of the house of Ahab. Son-in-law to King Ahab. And he went with Joram, that is, it would be his mother, it would be his uncle. He went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to the war against Hazael, the king of Syria, in Ramoth-Gilead, and the Syrians wounded his uncle Joram. And so the king Joram went back to Jezreel to be healed of the wounds which were inflicted by the Syrians there at the battle at Ramah, when he had fought against Hazael, the king of Syria. And Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, the king of Judah, went up to visit his uncle to see Jehoram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel, because he was sick as the result of his battle wounds. 22-year-old or 23-year-old kid at this time. And Elisha, the prophet, called one of the children of the prophets unto him. And he said, gird up your loins. Now, we told you that this is they wore the long robes, and when you need to hurry on a mission, you'd pull your robe up and tie a rope around so you'd have a short skirt so you could run. And so the gird up your loins is always preparing yourself to move fast, to run. You can't ever try and run in a robe. Of course not. You don't wear robes, but you can imagine how restricting it would be if the football players wore robes instead of, the tight pants and the pads and so forth. You know, I mean, it would be a slower game to be sure. So that you gird up your loins when you want to really move. And he said, take this box of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth-Gilead. And when you come there, look for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, who is the son of Nimshi. And go in and make him arise up from among his brethren and take him into the inner chamber. And then take the box of oil and pour it on his head and say, thus saith Jehovah, I have anointed you the king over Israel. And then open the door and split as fast as you can. Don't tarry. So the young man went, even as the prophet Elisha had told him, and he came to Ramoth-Gilead. And when he came there, behold, the captains of the host, the captains of the armies of Israel were sitting there, you know, just fellowshipping together. And he said, I have an errand unto thee, O captain. And Jehu said, to which one of us? And he said, to you, O captain. And so Jehu arose and went into the house, and the young man poured the oil on his head and said unto him, thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, I have anointed thee to be king over the people of Jehovah, even over Israel. Now, this to me is an interesting verse, in that he is speaking in the name of the Lord, and as he anoints him to be the king over Israel, he said, I anoint you to be the king over the people of Jehovah. Now, Israel had long ago forsaken Jehovah. Under the influence of Ahab and all, they were worshiping Baal. You remember Elijah said, you know, they have killed your servants and your prophets, and I am left, and they're trying to kill me. The Lord did say, I have 7,000 that I have reserved. But for the most part, the nation had forsaken God. But the fascinating thing to me is that God had not yet forsaken the nation. You know, that speaks to me volumes. The faithfulness of God to his people. And there are those that maybe have forsaken the Lord some time back, but the Lord has not yet forsaken them. God hangs on. The Spirit of God continues to call back into fellowship, to call to repentance. God doesn't let go easily. The Lord hangs on even long after we've been guilty of forsaking him. The Lord doesn't forsake his people. And what a beautiful thing it is to me that God still said, they're my people. They are the people of Jehovah. Though they had forsaken Jehovah, God still acknowledged them as his people. And he said, you shall smite the house of Ahab, your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all of the servants of Jehovah at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab every male and him that is shut up and left in Israel. Now, you're to go and you're to wipe out this house of Ahab, the descendants, all of them. You'll be my instrument of judgment. Now, God had, through Elijah, pronounced judgment that was going to come upon the house of Ahab. There, I think it's in the latter portion of the Kings, where Elisha pronounces upon him after this thing of the Naboth, appropriating, having Naboth murdered and then appropriating his property. The Lord said that, verse 21 of chapter 21, behold, I will bring evil upon thee. I will take away your posterity. I will cut off from Ahab every male. And so it's actually, he's quoting the portion of the prophecy here that Elijah gave unto Ahab. So this prophecy of God against Ahab was known by the people, for this young prophet quotes it to Jehu. I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. Those were the two dynasties that preceded the Omri dynasty that were totally wiped out. Now God is going to bring the end of this dynasty, and Jehu will begin a new dynasty that will go for four generations. And the dogs shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled. Now, this is the prophecy of Elijah. He said the dogs are going to eat Jezebel in the field of Naboth, that, you know, the guy that you had murdered, and there will be none to bury you. And This was the prophecy of Elijah. So this young kid gave him the prophecy, then he opened the door and ran. So Jehu came back out to these guys where he'd been, you know, eating with them and all. And one said unto him, "Is everything okay? Why did this fellow come to you?" And he said to them, "You know the man and his communication." And they said, "Is it false? Tell us now." And he said, "This is what he said to me, thus and thus. He said to me, saying, 'Thus saith Jehovah, I have anointed thee the king over Israel.'" So they hurried and took every man his garment, put it under him at the top of the stairs, and they blew with the trumpets, and they announced Jehu is king. So he was coronated there by the men on the spot. So Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. Now Joram had kept Ramoth-Gilead, he and all of Israel, because of Hazael, the king of Syria. But King Joram had returned to be healed there in Jezreel, which was one of the palaces. And he, from the wounds that he had as a result of the battle against Hazael. And Jehu said to the fellows that were there, "Now, if it's in your mind to make me the king, then don't let anyone escape from here, and go and warn Joram and tell it to them in Jezreel what we're doing." So Jehu rode in a chariot, and he came to Jezreel, for Joram was lying there, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, had come to visit his uncle. You remember we got that at the end of the last chapter. Ahaziah had come up to visit his uncle. And there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel, and he spied. He's this guy, watchman, and of course in those days he had the towers. They didn't have radio communications. Guys would sit there in the tower and watch for movement and action. And here he sees these chariots coming and the dust flying, and the guy looks, you know, at them. And so there stood a watchman at the tower, and he spied the company of Jehu as he came. And he said, "I see a company." And Joram said, "Take a horseman and send him to meet them, and let him say, 'Is it peace?'" So there went out one of the horsemen's, one of the guys on horseback, to meet him, and he said, "Thus saith the king, is it peace?" And Jehu said, "What have you to do with peace? Turn behind me." And so the watchman told them, saying, "The messenger came to them, but he's not coming back again." So he sent out the second on horseback, and when he came to them, he said, "Thus saith the king, is it peace?" And Jehu answered, "What have you to do with peace? Turn behind me." And the watchman told, saying, "He came even unto them, and he doesn't come back again. And the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously." In my younger days, my wife used to call me Jehu, because I drove my chariot furiously. So Joram said, "Make ready," and his chariot was made ready. And Joram, the king of Israel, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot, and they went out against Jehu, and they met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. They came out to meet, and it just so happened that in that field that Jezebel had taken from Naboth, is where they met. And it came to pass when Joram saw Jehu that he said, "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he answered, "What peace, so long as the whoredoms of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many?" How can there be peace with all of the wickedness that your mother has introduced to the land? Jehu had the proper concept that as long as you've got all of this corruption going on in the land, there can't be peace. As long as we have so much satanic worship and witchcraft and these things that are going on, there cannot be peace. There can't be peace in our land. There can't be peace in the world. And Joram turned his hands and he fled. And he said to Ahaziah, "There's treachery, O Ahaziah." And so Jehu drew a bow with his full strength. And he shot Jehoram between his arms. And the arrow went out at his heart. And he sunk down in his chariot. And then said Jehu to Bidkar, his captain, "Take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and you were riding together after Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden on him, saying, 'Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son,' saith Jehovah, 'and I will requite thee in this plat of ground,' saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him into that plat of ground according to the word of the Lord." So take his body and toss it there in that field that once belonged to Naboth, that he might die there. So when Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this young kid, just 23 years old, he fled by the way of the garden house. And Jehu followed after him and said to the fellows, "Smite him in his chariot." And they did so at the going up to Gur, which is by Ibleam. And he fled to the fortress city of Megiddo, and there he died. And his servants carried him in a chariot back to Jerusalem and buried him in the sepulcher with his fathers in the city of David. And in the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, began Ahaziah to reign over Judah. Now when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel, this wicked woman who had introduced the idolatry, the worship of Baal, who had killed the prophets of God, and who had gone out in vengeance against the servants of the Lord to destroy them out of the land. This wicked woman Jezebel heard that Jehu was coming, and so she put on her makeup and fixed her hair. She painted her face and teared her head, and she looked out the window. And as Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, "Had Zimri peace who slew his master?" Referring to a historic event that we've already covered, Zimri who had killed his master. So he lifted up his face to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And two or three eunuchs looked out at him, and he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot. That is, he just allowed his horse to stomp her to death. And when he was come into the house, he was eating and drinking, and he said, "Go and see now this cursed woman and bury her, for she is the king's daughter." Her father was the king of Sidon, and Ethbaal was his name. And so she was a king's daughter. And so he said, you know, at least give her the honor of a burial inasmuch as her dad's a king. And so they went out to bury her, but they did not find any more of her than just the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Interesting thing, when wild dogs, even to the present day, devour a body, a carcass, they don't eat the soles of the feet or the palms of the hand for some strange reason. And thus it was then, I guess, because that's all they found, the palms of her hands, the soles of her feet, and her skull. Nothing left really to... Wherefore they came again and told him, and he said, "This is the word of Jehovah, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, 'In the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel.'" Now this is a fulfillment of a prophecy of Elijah years earlier. "And the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, this is Jezebel. You won't be able to recognize her. The dogs will eat her. So the prophecy that was made by Elijah the prophet was fulfilled literally in Jezebel be eaten there of the dogs. Now, as we move on next week, we see this fellow Jehu, some interesting traits and characteristics, but also some weaknesses that led to he could have been perhaps a great king. He wasn't because of his weaknesses, but we do see some interesting and excellent traits in this fellow Jehu. So next week we'll continue with chapters 10 and 11. Read on. Interesting reading as we continue through this sort of historic account of what was going on at this particular time. Father, thank you again for the privilege of studying the Word. And Lord, help us that we might learn from the mistakes of the past, from the events that we have studied. And may we realize, Lord, the importance of committing our ways unto you, serving you completely, following after you, keeping ourselves and our lives from the defilement of idolatry, turning aside from you and becoming enamored of the things of the world, the material things. Lord, keep our minds, our hearts steadfast upon thee, that we might walk, Lord, after the Spirit and the things of the Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you. Keep his hand upon your life and watch over you through the week. And may you be strengthened by that hand of the Lord. And may you be led by the Spirit. May God open up doors of opportunity for you to share your love for Jesus with someone else. And may your life become a real witness of God's grace as you share with others the work of His Spirit within your own life. God bless you and keep you in His name.